now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Paul Blake Smith. Paul was born in Cape Girardeau's Southeast Hospital, raised in town, and educated by the Cape Public School System. He was a four-year mass communications major with an English minor at Southeast Missouri State University. Paul's grandfather, Randolph P. Smith, was a 50-year practice attorney in Cape and was also a judge, plus the town city attorney for 10 years. Paul's father was his grandfather's paralegal assistant, having been educated in Cape at SEMO and at Washington University Law School. Paul's mother was a longtime school teacher in nearby Scott County, where some feel the 1941 UFO crash occurred, just outside of Cape City and county borders. Today, Paul lives and works in western Missouri, working on other books and movie screenplays. Paul has been the featured guest on numerous radio shows, such as the internationally syndicated Coast to Coast AM and Unexplained Phenomenon Radio, plus a podcast from England and from France. He's also been written about in newspapers in Southeast Missouri and the subject of YouTube interview videos with journalist Linda Moulton Howe. We're really excited to have Paul Blake Smith with us. He's the author of Mo 41, The Bombshell Before Roswell, and his latest book is Three Presidents, Two Accidents, More Mo 41 UFO Crash Data and Surprises. So without any further ado, Paul Smith, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, and I hope all of your listeners are. We've got a great story for you tonight. Sit back and relax, get comfortable. We've got a real wild, real-life, nonfiction story to tell you.
Well, we're really excited about it, because for many years I would tell people that Roswell is the case that makes the case for alien contact and the existence of alien life forms in our atmosphere and in our planet. But for many years, my colleagues and I have heard rumors about a crash retrieval in Cape Girardeau, Missouri in 1941. So before you delve into that, Paul, could you tell us a bit about yourself and how you were drawn into this subject?
Well, I grew up in Cape Girardeau, and I'm a little embarrassed to say, when I moved away, that's when I first heard of the story. I talked to my parents, and they had not heard the story, but my stepmother told me she heard the tale when she was growing up in Cape Girardeau and going to high school in the 1960s. When I was a boy, I played Little League baseball in the park in Cape Girardeau, and one of my umpires was a big beefy fellow. He went by the name Rusty. And he's heard the story. You know him better today as Rush Limbaugh, the broadcaster. A few years ago, someone called up his radio show and said, "Rush, what's up with this UFO crash in your hometown of Cape Girardeau, Missouri?" And instead of dismissing the caller and saying, "I don't want to talk about such things," he simply said, "There's more to this story than you might think." And he moved on to the next caller. Usually Rush has no tolerance for crazy kooky sort of stories and paranoid conspiracy theories and such. I've been told since then that Rush has told some friends that he also heard the Cape Girardeau UFO tale when he was growing up in the late 50s or early 60s in Cape Girardeau. So for the American public, the Cape Girardeau tale really began to take off when a woman typed up a letter and sent it to a UFO researcher in the 1990s. And more researchers began looking into this, including the famous ones like Leonard Stringfield, Dr. Stanton Friedman, Linda Moulton Howe, Ryan S. Wood, And they all concluded that this may well have happened. And I wanted to know more about this story from my own hometown, and it was featured in a few radio programs and a sci-fi channel special for about 2 minutes, and I can't find any books about it, just a reference here or a paragraph here or there in a book on UFOs, and I thought, there's not a single book on this subject. Someone should do something about this, and I thought, well, I'm somebody, so I will. So I wrote what became Mo 41, The Bombshell Before Roswell, and it came out in the spring of last year and did rather surprisingly well. I'm very pleased. And I had so much material that I wasn't able to get in the book. And then more material came in from listeners and viewers and readers. They provided me with more data. And so I came up with a second book called Three Presidents, Two Accidents, More Mo 41 UFO Crash Data and Surprises, and that's a book that is out. You can get both of them from Argus Publishing, my very fine publishers, who offer free shipping. So you can also go to any major online book retailer and ask for it. You might find it only in electronic book form, ebook, but they might have a physical copy too, so I urge you to do that.
What was it about the story, aside from the local angle, Paul, the fact that some people, some neighbors, may have even known about this story? How was it exactly that you got into it, and what hooked you into it? And tell us about the voyage of discovery, how this came about, how your sources started coming to you.
Well, it all began when a woman named Charlotte Huffman Mann typed up this letter, and it got printed up in a couple of books. And investigated, and I began reading this letter. I thought, holy smokes, I know some of these people in some of these places, including a possible newsman who doubled as a photographer for the local Cape Girardeau newspaper. He was pretty well known to my family. He passed away in the early 1990s, and so many folks have passed away, I found, as I began asking questions, looking around, trying to interview people. The story is now 75 years old. Actually, we're close to the 76th anniversary. Very difficult to research because not only are the eyewitnesses all gone, but so are their children in many cases. There's maybe a third generation, and some people were afraid to talk. And that made it even more difficult when you're afraid to talk in the first place, or you only hand down little whispers or rumors that you heard. But I was able to cobble the story together for a variety of sources and to do plenty of research into, on a national scale, as I call it, the actions of President Roosevelt. His most trusted Army advisor, that would be General George Marshall, very famous Army Chief of Staff, later became Secretary of State. And then there was Harry S. Truman, who was very famous United States president, and even I was a little startled to find out Harry is a former resident of Cape Girardeau in the summer of 1906, where he trained for the Army. And then I looked into what was Eleanor Roosevelt doing on what I feel was the night of the crash. And other data came together, and I believe I could state with a fair amount of certainty, reasonable speculation, that April 12th, 1941, a Saturday night, was the night of the crash. I always refrain from wild theories, crazy paranoid conspiracy stuff, and I try to present facts whenever possible and point out reasonable or logical speculation and not get too carried away, and I always cram my books with as many facts as I can get and put the sources and resources in the back so you can look things up and find out why I put in what I did and what I really think of things. You find that in the very back under resource notes. So I've been pleased by the response. I've gotten good reviews, and I think it's a story that is catching on. It was the Cape Girardeau UFO crash was featured on the History Channel Ancient Aliens this summer. In late August, they featured not only the Cape Girardeau story, but they showed a close-up of the cover of my book, Mo 41, The Bombshell Before Roswell. I was quite surprised even myself. They did not tell me in advance. So I'm hoping we'll get more action on digging into this matter, possibly, literally, digging into some soil. But it's kind of touchy in that the crash site is farm. It's somebody's home. It's somebody's business. It is private property. I do not recommend anyone flying to Cape Girardeau and start poking around out in the woods and the cropland where this apparently took place. Not only are there farmers with shotguns, but I've been warned many times that this land is rife with rattlesnakes and copperheads. It's very, yes, very dangerous to even go walking around poking about. So it makes for a great story, but that made it even more tough to investigate and research on my own.
Could you take our listeners through the timeline? What were the key events that precipitated this? Of course, the alien spaceship crash. Who were the key players involved locally and then nationally? And how did the story develop from there over time?
Okay. Let's begin with the actions of a Cape Girardeau minister who worked for the Red Star Tabernacle in downtown. He lived about two blocks from the church itself. His name was Reverend William Huffman. And he was relaxing at home with his family one night when he got a phone call. This must have been around 9 or so, give or take a half hour. It was dark, and it had been unusually warm in Cape Girardeau the Easter Passover weekend, I found. So he may well have had his lights on and his windows open. And Reverend Huffman got a phone call, and it was from a member or an associate of the Cape Girardeau Police Department. This person said, "There's been a terrible plane crash outside of town. We've been called that there was a fireball and a crash of an airplane. We need to get out there right away. How about coming along with us to provide whatever spiritual comfort you can give?" Now, I did some research and found out that Reverend Huffman did not name this police associate, but I found out a man who lived directly across the street from him was Cape Girardeau's Justice of the Peace. And this man was a member of the Red Star Tabernacle Church and would have known Reverend Huffman quite well. He could just peek out his window and see Reverend Huffman was home. Of all the ministers in Cape Girardeau, it's very strange this man was called. He was not actually doing pastoral sermonizing and preaching at the time. He was in town as a fundraiser and someone to lift up morale and spirits at the Red Star Church. So he would naturally have been home, especially with his daughter-in-law heavily pregnant at the time, and his family gathered together during the Easter weekend. Now, Cape Girardeau was a very religious town, very church-going conservatives then, and pretty much still the same. It was a town of about 20,000 people in those days. Today it has doubled. It's around 40,000. But at any rate, Reverend Huffman has long since passed away. His wife passed away. His two sons have passed away. But his granddaughter lived to find out more about this story by asking her grandmother about the tale before Grandmother Huffman passed away. She had stage 4 cancer. She was dying. And Charlotte Huffman Mann, the granddaughter of Reverend William Huffman, got all the facts she could from Grandma and wrote it down and put it in a letter. She checked with her own sister to make sure the facts were accurate and eventually sent the letter to a UFO researcher named Ray Fowler, who passed it along to Leonard Stringfield. But anyway, Reverend Huffman got in a car, an unmarked car, and went off into the night that mid-April of 41 with this associate of the police department. And they went about 12 or 13 miles outside of town, and they could see a fire going on. There had been supposedly a fireball with the crash, presenting a fire in a farmer's field. So when he arrived, there was smoke and fire, and there was a fuselage on the ground. Sure enough, an aircraft had landed, crash landed, and when he got closer, he noticed there was quite a crowd gathering, because that was not a cylindrical airplane fuselage or chassis. That was a strange round disc, a gray metal disc. We might call it brushed aluminum or brushed nickel. Today, it was very shiny and smooth without seemingly any rivets or seams in it or bolts. And it was all circular except for at one point it was all busted open with a view of the inside of the craft available. And at one point, Reverend Huffman said he went over and took a nice big peek inside this strange craft, and he could see tiny seats. He could see a kind of dashboard, kind of interior cockpit or flight deck, with panels and perhaps gauges and dials and such. And he looked around and saw that there was a gray metal band around the inside of the cockpit with strange hieroglyphic symbols on it, and he couldn't make these things out. He couldn't understand what these symbols were. So, thanks to the blown-out section of this craft, there was a debris field with little pieces of shrapnel, silvery metal, laying all around the farm field. Even amidst the flames, something caused a fire, but the Cape Girardeau Fire Department, he said, were there putting out the fire. Also present were the Cape Girardeau Police Department, the FBI, and the news photographers, two of them who had big flash cameras, and these cameras would go off every now and then as they took pictures and scribbled notes for what was probably the biggest story in human history. I'm sure they were very excited about this event. It was just after sundown when the crash occurred, and so Reverend Huffman had his duty to perform, and that was to say some prayers over the victims. He was expecting human beings. He was, of course, shocked to find these small, gray, alien creatures, little men, if you will. Two of them were laying side by side in the grass away from the craft. Someone told him that they had been pulled from the vehicle and laid side by side, and they were dead, clearly not moving or responding in any way, staring up into the sky with big black eyes, and had long, skinny arms and legs, and they seemed almost like rubber, like soft material practically. They had long, skinny fingers, three fingers and one long, skinny thumb on each hand. So they seemed to have crinkly-type skin, or at least a tight-fitting flight suit, if you will. It was difficult to tell. It may have been a reaction to the skin, to planet Earth's oxygen-rich atmosphere, and that may be actually what killed these creatures. They could not breathe our air. But there was a third creature nearby. Reverend Huffman said his prayers over the first two, and he knelt over the third, if you will, man or person. And this completely gray, identical being was still breathing. He could see the chest going up and down. And, of course, Reverend Huffman was astounded and didn't know quite what to think or what to say or what to do. So he said his prayers, and as he did so, this creature seemed to expire. The chest stopped moving. There was no response. He was inert. And Reverend Huffman said, "I was careful not to touch this creature, just to say my prayers." And while he was doing this, two local Cape Girardeau men picked up one of the dead aliens, propped him up, held his arms out under the arms and stretched him out and posed for a photograph from one of the two newsmen that were present. The newsman didn't use his big speed graphic camera, the big flash camera. He pulled out a little pocket camera, possibly a Brownie Kodak, and he snapped just one picture. Now, in my family, I'm distantly related to a man named Garland Fronenberger, who was a newsman and photographer for the Southeast Missourian. He was a big camera buff. He used a speed graphic. And my aunt said that when she was in the family home in Cape Girardeau, Garland would drop by and recommended once that she use a Brownie Kodak camera. She knew the man and even heard him say these things to her about what kind of camera would be best for a young person, matching the exact description of this man who was at the site but not named by Reverend Huffman. Well, when I began to read and hear this story by Charlotte Huffman Mann of her grandparents' memories, I thought, I've got her now. There was no FBI, no Federal Bureau of Investigation agents in Cape Girardeau in 1941, and in researching this, I found out I'm wrong. There actually was. They opened up a field office in Cape Girardeau in the old post office downtown 1 month before the crash. And why would they do such a thing? They were searching for saboteurs and spy rings in the Southeast Missouri area. This was April 1941. We were still several months away from joining the war effort after Pearl Harbor. But America was very, very worried about Adolf Hitler and Nazi aggression in Europe. They were winning the war, sadly, against the Allies at that time, and the Japanese were running rampant in the Pacific theater. 1941 was a very bad year for people who love peaceful coexistence and democracy. The forces of totalitarianism were running rampant. Well, that answers why the Cape Girardeau story had to be covered up right from the start. The FBI did not want spy rings or possible espionage agents to find out about this crash, this strange disc, possibly from another world. They don't want this information relayed back to Nazi Germany. Cape Girardeau had a very large German population in those days, and I understand they even had church services. One service would be given only in German. So hardly all Cape Girardeau Germans were pro-Nazi. You can easily be German and not be fond of Adolf Hitler and his machinations and his regime. But only a small handful would be necessary to get that information relayed to Nazi Germany that we had a new secret weapon possibly on our hands, this recovered alien craft. So that would be one reason why this had to be hushed up right from the start. A second reason was because Reverend Huffman said the army came in fairly quickly, maybe between 9:30, 10, 10:15 at night, and they hemmed in the site, and they told everyone, you did not see this, this did not happen, this is a matter of national security, you were to hand over all notes and film and photographs, you were to hand over all shrapnel and debris, all evidence that this happened, and you're not to speak to anyone at any time for the rest of your lives about this event, for the good of your country. Keep quiet. Well, that's a pretty powerful statement, and back in 1941, you did pretty much what the government told you. There wasn't a lot of rebellion or backtalk, if you want to call it that. Reverend Huffman said he was sworn to secrecy, and he went home, and his family was so upset seeing him shaken and pale and rattled about the whole night's event that he said, I'm going to tell you this story once, and then I'm never going to speak of it again. He did tell his family what had happened in that field, and apparently he lived up to his word. He kept his mouth shut for the rest of his life. It would have been really worth his job if he started speaking up in Cape Girardeau about alien spaceships and crash landings and government plans to take over and keep you quiet. It would have sounded very wild to the average person, and he would probably be booted from his job. It was in almost everyone's best interest to keep your mouth shut and don't discuss this matter if you value your existence, really, your job and your way of life. So Reverend Huffman told his family that night, gathered at the family home, probably close to midnight, and 2 weeks later, after the crash, photographer who took that Brownie Kodak picture showed up at his front porch and said, I have a copy of this picture I took of the alien being propped up by two men on each, one on each side. And he says, I have a copy and I want you to have a copy. So Reverend Huffman took this picture most reluctantly, but he took it, and the photographer took off pretty quick because there was an air of rather fear and paranoia that you really shouldn't be talking about this and having souvenirs and having evidence. It would have gotten them in quite some hot water, so Reverend Huffman gave the picture to his son, who tucked it away somewhere, and the family held on to it for about a dozen years. Charlotte Huffman Mann was born in that period, and when she was a little girl, her family was living in Kansas, a small town in Kansas, where they would have family get-togethers and occasionally pull out the photograph and look it over in control of the father who had possession of the photo still. And there would be little whispers and rumors about this Missouri UFO crash and this flying saucer and these little people. And Charlotte wanted to know more. She was mesmerized by the image of the alien in this photograph. But they didn't want to tell her too much. She was an innocent little girl, and they felt like she knows probably too much already. Let's keep it from her, at least until she grows older. Well, one night they invited a neighbor from across the street to a dinner party and got into the subject of otherworldly beings and trotted out the photograph to show this man. And he said, well, I know something about photography, and I know another man who's familiar with wildlife. Why don't I go show this picture to him and I'll get it back to you? This man turned out to be an Army intelligence officer during the war. He took the picture and he never went back. He didn't go back to the family and take the picture back. He didn't even stick around. He moved out of that Kansas town pretty quick. He was tracked down in the 1990s as an old man living in Albuquerque, not far from Sandia National Labs, near the Albuquerque airport. Sandia has quite a reputation for holding on to UFO wreckage and back engineering and reverse engineering otherworldly craft. But we'll get into that maybe later. But anyway, this man denied that he took the picture and then admitted he'd seen the picture and that he gave it back. And then he had evasive, slippery answers. He didn't seem to want to talk about it. He would grow very testy and surly in what few interviews he gave and claim that he worked for the State Department at one time and that he worked in Washington, D.C. as a photographer for a news service and was close to JFK and LBJ during those years. And so, without saying much more, he passed away a little over 10 years ago, I believe, and so that's kind of where that mystery resides. So in doing some more research about the tale, I found out there was a Cape Girardeau fireman who was on his deathbed, also with stage 4 cancer, and he told his family, "You've heard these rumors about this spaceship crash outside of town. Well, I'm going to tell you this. These tales are absolutely true." He said, "I should know. I was there. I was a part of the firefighting contingent. We went out to the crash, saw the bodies, saw the spaceship, saw the debris, saw the crowd that had gathered. And the army came in, just like the Reverend Huffman story goes." And he said the soldiers caught the fireman, his name was Walter Reynolds, caught him trying to pocket a piece of the debris. And the fireman Reynolds said, "They yelled at me, chewed me out, forced me to give the debris, the shrapnel back. I was not allowed to have a souvenir. Then they booted me out of the crash site." And he said he was pretty sure he's being watched around town in the aftermath and that his phone was tapped. So we do know that in 1941, all through the Great Depression, FBI director J. Edgar Hoover, very famous man, longtime director of the FBI, was crazy about wiretapping and tapping and bugging into people's homes and their phones. So it could be that Fireman Reynolds is telling the absolute truth, and the FBI was there at the time. They were monitoring spy rings and watching people around town anyway. And it could have been that they were worried about Fireman Reynolds, who kept the story pretty quiet until he reached old age and had cancer. So that's another confirming story. Obviously, the fireman passed away, and I began to find little bits and pieces. If you are able to pick up a copy of my book, you'll read all the first and second-hand tales that I was able to put together. But we could also go into what was happening in the White House on the night of the crash, and where was FDR, and what would have been the natural reactions of a U.S. president to this astounding news. But before we get to that, why don't we discuss who could have been these army people? How could they have reached Cape Girardeau's farm field so fast? And the answer to that comes in an army aerial training program in a small town called Sikeston, Missouri, which was about 35 miles to the south. Now, the Cape County Sheriff just happened to be a man named Reuben Shoddy. His brother, Ben Shoddy, worked for the Sikeston Army Aerial Training Program. So all it took was one quick phone call from the county sheriff responding to what he thought was an aircraft going down, a simple airplane. And when he got there, he thought, "Oh my gosh, this is the most amazing thing at all. We better call the Army and their aerial training people in." I don't know this for sure, but it is a logical speculation, and all it took was one quick call to the brother, Don and Sikeston, and he galvanized a search party, or not really a rescue mission, but a response by the Army. And it turns out that Charles Burton Root was the captain and the commander of this aerial training program in Sikeston, and he had come to Missouri directly from Washington, D.C. So he knew his contacts, he knew some big shots in the Army, and probably the War Department. And so all it took was a couple of quick phone calls, get some men together in trucks, and drive the 35 miles up the highway and find the crash as directed by the county sheriff. And that's how they could have responded so quickly that night, been on the scene, and had direct orders, round this up and keep it suppressed.
Was there any indication of where the craft was taken to, like an intermediate stop perhaps, and maybe where it ultimately wound up at?
There is a woman named Linda L. Wallace who's done some very fine research on this matter. Her father was based in Sykeston at that Army Aerial Training Center, and he did not speak of it during his lifetime, but she spoke, Linda spoke to other family members who would give hints and clues here and there that, yes, there was something of this nature, rumors of an otherworldly craft that her father may have possibly seen this material. The whole unit may have, or at least some of the training unit may have seen this material and recovered it and took it back to Sykeston to hold on to it for a little while. Proper procedure had someone commanded from the Sykeston unit under the Captain Charles Root. Now, it's interesting to note that there's another story of another Christian pastor who saw the Cape Girardeau finds, the recoveries, only he did not know where they came from. This man was a gentleman called Turner Holt. Reverend Holt was from Ohio and was visiting Washington, D.C. at the time because his cousin was FDR's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. Cordell Hull said, "I want you to come over to the U.S. Capitol building. I've got something to show you." And Reverend Holt said, "Okay." They got to the outdoor exterior steps to the building. Cordell Hull swore his cousin to secrecy. Reverend Holt said, "Yes, I will remain silent. What are we going to go see?" And Cordell Hull wouldn't tell him. He said, "Just follow me. Come with me." And they went down flight after flight of stairs and down the elevator in the U.S. Capitol building and went down to the sub-basement. And they went to a special locked room where they went inside, and here was a complete match for the Cape Girardeau recoveries, including three small gray aliens with no visible injuries, just like Reverend Huffman saw. They were kept in three glass jars, swimming around in a kind of clear formaldehyde fluid. And there was a rounded, silvery gray spaceship crashed that cracked open. It was in sections cut up to, in order to fit it into this building and into this room, but it was clearly a rounded gray metal craft that had a busted open point, and there was a box, I believe a box of debris and shrapnel. And so Reverend Turner Holt's daughter spoke up many years later and said, "Daddy said there were three aliens in three glass jars in this special room." And the two daughters of Reverend Holt recalled that their father told them the story and said, "Keep this to yourself until after I've passed away, and then tell the world what I saw, that Cordell Hull showed me these creatures from another world and said, we can't talk about this to the American public because it would start a panic. They were afraid it would." Remember that the Cape Girardeau UFO crash of 1941 happened just a few years after the Orson Welles production of War of the Worlds. Yes. And that started a mild, fearful reaction. It was overblown by Orson Welles in the aftermath. He called it a great panic, and people were having heart attacks and running from their homes, and almost all of that was nonsense and didn't happen. But it gave the impression that it did happen, so the American government would have kept that in mind also as something like, we don't want to start any kind of panic amongst the people. We've got to continue to keep this secret. So Reverend Holt, Turner Holt, and Cordell Hull looked this material over, and then they left the Capitol building. And you would think, well, this is a crazy-sounding story. Aliens kept underneath the U.S. Capitol building. But the more you hear about the situation at the time, you might realize this is the perfectly logical place. Back in May of last year, I was watching 60 Minutes, the American television program, and they showed the U.S. Congress releasing a 9/11 report they'd been sitting on for many years. And they went down to the bowels of the sub-basement of the Capitol building to this special locked room and brought out the report. It was on television. Here was the doorway, and they locked it up, and the hallway, and they showed just this rather briefly. I'm sure they were not allowed to go in, but it was a special locked room way down below the Capitol, proving that such a room does exist. It certainly got security guards and probably army personnel in the building in 1941. It had sworn U.S. congressmen and senators who often form committees to look into matters. And above and beyond all of that, the President of the United States, the Vice President, the Speaker of the House, and the Director of the FBI were all devout Freemasons. Freemasons are, for various reasons, wild about the U.S. Capitol building. I find it, the U.S. Capitol, pictured on Freemason literature to this day. They hold the Capitol building in great reverence and respect, and they undoubtedly gathered some congressmen and senators over the years for confabs, probably in offices below the U.S. Capitol. In the vast territory, there's actually more floor space below the surface of the Capitol than there is within the two halls of Congress on the top floors. So even Missouri's Grand Master Freemason in 1941 was a man named Senator Harry Truman, former Cape Girardeau resident. And so it all starts to tie together why this material would have been tucked away in this special room that no one would really think about as a place for anything out of this world, which gave it an even greater advantage. So what sounds at first a bit ridiculous becomes more and more possible. In Washington in 1941, they would have been rather fearful about reprisals from any alien beings, and where could they stash this stuff where extraterrestrials would never find it and never go all the way downstairs into the rooms below the Capitol. So FDR likely gave the approval. The Vice President Henry Wallace had an office in the Capitol. Wallace and Roosevelt, a few years earlier, before the crash, were instrumental in getting Freemason symbols put into the American Great Seal of America that you see on American currency to this day. They were so devoted to Freemasonry. And Freemasons, by the way, are very much into stars, position in the sky, some of outer space matters, and some of them are into astrology and astronomy. So it really starts to figure when you think in 1941 there was no NSA, CIA, there wasn't even a Pentagon or a great holding facility like the Smithsonian. Well, I don't know. Was the Smithsonian open back then? I don't think you would put it in a museum where the public is in and out anyways. But at any rate, these two stories hold together. I don't think the Cape Girardeau materials were in Sykeston for very long. I think after a day or so, they were probably loaded onto a plane and flown to Washington. Now, it's interesting to note that Linda Wallace, in researching the Sykeston angle of the story, said one of her family members talked about a giant cargo plane that landed at the Sykeston airport. It really stuck out, and out stepped a bunch of armed guards to surround it. And this would be likely around the time of the crash and be a kind of military reaction. A typical reaction is to guard it in a large craft and fly it, no matter what it is, this material, and get it out of there and get it into the hands of the Army brass and the War Department and the President under his control. So the stories have no flaming or smoking gun proof, but they all hang together when you consider the secondhand evidence, facts, logical speculation, and so forth.
Later in this interview, I'd like you to comment more, Paul, about some of the second and third-hand witnesses. For now, I'd like you to comment on some of the perhaps corroborative evidence in the form of documentation released either by the Freedom of Information Act, released via whistleblowers on the inside. Robert Wood and Ryan Wood, they've done a great job amassing a lot of these documents together in their Majestic 12 website. I recall that the Cape Girardeau crash retrieval was mentioned in a few such documents. Would you like to comment on that?
I sure would. Even took the answer right out of my mouth that I would advise all listeners to go to www.majesticdocuments.com, a great internet site from Ryan S. Wood, a very fine researcher and author. He has written one chapter about the Cape Girardeau crash in one of his very fine books. He helped produce and write the sci-fi special, The Secret, Evidence That We Are Not Alone, that covered the Cape Girardeau crash and recreated it for about 2 minutes within the special. And they got into some of the documents that have been released or leaked over the years. And some of those are from FDR himself, including an Oval Office memo in which he talked about these celestial wonders that have come to us and how they must remain great secrets of state. And another one spoke about forming a non-terrestrial science and technology committee headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Dr. Bush was the head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development in Washington, D.C., an FDR favorite. He was assigned by FDR to come up with weapons programs, high-tech technology that would help aid the American military and certainly the coming war effort. And in my research, I found Dr. Bush was called in to FDR's Oval Office just days after the crash. And so he was called in to speak with FDR in this private huddle, along with FDR's personal physician, the Surgeon General of the Navy. And in discussing this matter with Ryan S. Wood, he said this would have been very logical. It would have been asking for an autopsy. Dr. Vannevar Bush, the scientist, would have been asked to autopsy the spacecraft, see what makes it tick, what made it work. And Dr. McIntyre, the Surgeon General, would have been asked to autopsy the bodies and see what made them tick, what made them work once, and get a complete makeup of these creatures. And Ryan S. Wood added that the Office of Surgeon General of the Navy is present in other UFO documents talking about autopsying the Roswell and other alien crash bodies that have been found. So it hangs together once again. President Roosevelt issued a directive that can be found in Ryan Wood's website, and I mention it in my book, to General Marshall to let the scientific minds that FDR put together more and better access to this material, these celestial wonders. And he thanked the Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology Committee for coming to the conclusion that we are not alone in the universe, that there is other intelligence. These are from 1942, 1943, 44, these kinds of memos that you can read for yourself. And they can't be about anything other than the Cape Girardeau crash, quite frankly, and how we've got to investigate this and keep it a secret as a matter of state. And they were urging FDR after Pearl Harbor to weaponize this, see if we can turn this into a weapon, perhaps through our atomic weapons program. And there we get into another amazing subject. If the atomic propulsion system of this Cape Girardeau crash was applied to the Manhattan Project, as has been claimed in another document.
I'm a student of World War II, and I study military history, and I never cease to be fascinated over the fact that so many of the key players of that era, General George Marshall, General William Donovan, the founder of the OSS, is even mentioned in some of these documents.
Right.
And another person who comes up is Jack Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, who at the time of the Cape Girardeau crash was in the Office of Naval Intelligence. Would you like to comment on that, Paul?
I sure will. That's part of my second book, Three Presidents, Two Accidents. I take a look at the actions of FDR, Harry Truman, and JFK. And at the time of the actual crash in April of 41, Jack Kennedy was just a grad student at Stanford University on the west coast of America. And during the course of the year, he suddenly just rose up at a meteoric pace to become a trusted member of the Office of Naval Intelligence without one bit of training at the Naval Academy. They got him to pass a physical after like three tries. He kept failing. He was not always in the greatest of health. He was a skinny young man. And they put him right in the intelligence community in the Office of Naval Intelligence. And as I mentioned before, it could have been, well, a logical step to say that the Surgeon General of the Navy and the Naval Intelligence was handling the autopsy of the bodies. And in late 1941, let's say October, November, December, JFK was right there in their midst in Washington, D.C. He was given a job of typing reports, handling briefing documents. One author said that he has understood it that young Jack Kennedy was a liaison with the White House, with FDR, would go there with important sensitive documents, bringing them to FDR, the president, in the Oval Office, and taking them home. I'd like to see confirmation of that claim, but for the most part, it's pretty much assured that JFK and his sister were living in Washington, and they did a lot of gossiping. It was important to Kathleen Kennedy, his sister. She worked as a newspaper columnist secretary and eventually took over that column. And it was important to gather all the latest dirt and scoop and information they could. So JFK and his sister in the evenings would attend lots of parties and hobnob with the brass and people in the know in military matters and government matters. And this went on until even after Pearl Harbor. But JFK had his phone tapped at one point, and the FBI was following him. And we have to ask, what was Kennedy talking about over his phone that was getting him all of this government surveillance by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, sounding very much like this Walter Reynolds, a Cape Girardeau fireman I mentioned previously, who also said his phone was tapped and he was being monitored around Cape Girardeau. Now, it is true that JFK was having an affair with a technically married woman, a beautiful young lady named Inga Arvad, and there's a brand new biography out on her, by the way. Inga was a reporter for a newspaper, and it was her job also to get the juiciest scoops. So there's no telling what Jack Kennedy, his sister, and their friend Inga were finding out and talking over the phone and in person that would cause the FBI to be so alarmed that they would shadow them and wiretap them. And this continued even after JFK was transferred to South Carolina in mid-January of 1942. Eventually, he trained for a PT unit and was the commander of his own boat in the Pacific. He was shipped out, and that was the end of his romance. So that was a little-known fact that I was surprised to uncover. This was a little surprising to me. It was in late 1941, hobnobbing with all of these big shots, possibly from Congress, certainly the military, where JFK first announced to his friends and family that he someday felt he was going to run for president. He wanted to be president of the United States. And so you have to wonder what he found out about Cape Girardeau. I have no smoking gun, but it's interesting to note that according to a leaked CIA document, JFK talked about having visited an Air Force base when he was president and saw the bodies of small gray aliens and a crashed ship. Marilyn Monroe, his lover, said JFK talked about this. She even described the bodies to a friend of hers named Robert Slatzer, who gave an interview before he died and talked about these juicy secrets from the president and Marilyn. And they included descriptions of things that sounded like they could have been from Cape Girardeau, possibly another crash such as Roswell, I'll admit. But JFK is always known to have had a healthy curiosity. And in an interview I saw on television, his son, JFK Jr., said that was one big thing about my father. He had a tremendous curiosity about things. He would really look into matters open-mindedly. So it certainly fits with the pattern that he may have found out a little too much. And I go into more detail if you want to read the second book that deals with what JFK was doing at the time and why he possibly was in the know on other matters related to UFOs. And there is the contingent of UFO authors and researchers who feel that was a big reason why President Kennedy was assassinated, that he wanted to go public with what he knew about the truth about alien visitation and sharing these notions with the Soviet Union. And that was one of the factors that got him killed. I don't go into that too much, but those are some serious allegations, and it's difficult for me to dispute them, certainly.
In the time we have left in the first half, and I'd like you to elaborate more on this in the second half, Paul, we hear a lot about Harry Truman being involved in the Roswell case, where he was apprised of the Roswell crash retrieval. He was kept in the loop from the beginning. And you point out Harry Truman was a National Guardsman. He was living in Cape Girardeau at one point, and somehow, some way, his stock soared, and he wound up becoming vice president and then president. What, if any, tie-in does the Grandmaster Mason Harry Truman have with the Cape Girardeau UFO crash in 1941?
if there's anyone who ties in the Cape Girardeau city level, the state level of Missouri, and Washington, D.C., the Army and the federal government knowing about this and keeping it hushed up, it would be Harry Truman, who, as I we mentioned just now, once lived in Cape, had campaigned in Cape Girardeau for the Senate, and in 1940, this is an amazing fact, I was startled to find it out, FDR did not really like Harry Truman, did not support him for re-election, supported his primary opponent in the Democratic Party. He didn't want Harry back in Washington, even though they were both Freemasons. They were quite different gentlemen. Harry was once a dirt farmer, a former Missouri farmer and haberdasher, and he could be a little crude or blunt, straightforward. And meanwhile, FDR was a bit of a patrician from a wealthy New York family. So FDR backed Missouri's governor at the time in the primary. Well, Harry won that primary, and he won the fall election. He had been in Cape Girardeau campaigning, I believe, that previous year in the fall of 1940. So here's the biggest turnaround in perhaps American presidential history, from obscure nobody senator who wasn't welcomed back by the president. Of all the men in the Democratic Party, Harry Truman was selected by FDR to become vice president and, of course, the next president of the United States. What caused this complete 180 turn here and FDR to support Harry? President Roosevelt had told some secretaries and a couple of friends that he did not feel he was going to finish his final term in 1944, that he would either resign after the war was won, or that he felt maybe his health was just not going to give him enough time to complete the term. Therefore, it would have been very, very important to pick someone very informed and very capable and special to be his vice president, knowing this man would take over as United States president. Well, of all the people in the whole United States, he picked Missourian Harry Truman, and he proved to be quite up for the job. Just after World War II was won, 1 month after, really, or less than a month, Harry Truman traveled to southeast Missouri, and the news articles show he was met by a Cape Girardeau contingent that urged him to come back to Freemason meetings downtown in Cape. And where was the Freemason meeting hall? It was just steps away from a special building in downtown that had been used during the war for a secret factory, I was startled to find out, that made parts of the atomic bomb and other weapons and communication gear. It was a Ford auto dealership upstairs factory. So Harry would have been in and out of Cape Girardeau, and during the war effort, this factory was doing its patriotic duty in Cape Girardeau citizens, and it was all under the auspices of a man named Fred Groves. The atomic weapons program in Washington at the Pentagon for FDR was being run by a General Leslie Groves. So I began to wonder, are the two connected? I was never able to find a positive smoking gun at this point, but I'm pretty sure that at some point the two men were connected by blood relations, and that's how Fred Groves of Cape Girardeau received this contract to do the factory work in Cape Girardeau right near the Freemason Lodge. And so Harry was aware and tying in all of this, and of course he was the president that authorized the use of the Manhattan Project, the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan to win the war effort. So there's just all kinds of interesting connections that I have some of that in my first book and more in the second book, and I think students of history, such as yourself, will find it very interesting indeed.
I read somewhere that Harry Truman was quoted as saying that he was more proud of becoming a 33rd degree Freemason than he was of becoming a U.S. president.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, interesting.
Also, a YouTube video you can catch of 1952, some reporters caught Harry Truman and asked him, what about all these UFO sightings lately? And he says, oh, we've always had that going on, UFOs and whatnot. And we discussed it with the military at every conference we had. And it's just an astounding statement. The official government line was that UFOs don't exist. It's just silly business. It's not worth discussing. And yet he let slip on camera that you can see in a video to this day online, Harry admitting on camera that they discussed this matter with the military at every conference he had as president. wow, that gives you a more revealing look at what was actually taking place behind the scenes in those days.
I have to look that up. And one thing about Harry was nobody could say that he wasn't decisive, because he fired a very popular five-star general, General Douglas MacArthur,
right,
during the Korean War. Took a lot of heat for that, but it was something that he felt had to be done. So, you know, he was one that came up with the phrase, what was it, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, the buck stops here. I forget which one, but
yeah,
he was known for being quite decisive. Well, we've reached the end of the first hour. Paul, could you tell our listeners what your website address is and how they can contact you if they have any information about Cape Girardeau or anything else?
Okay, you can contact me at an email address that you can find on the website at www.mo41.info, and you can also find me on Facebook. Look for the Facebook page, Cape Girardeau's 1941 UFO Crash, America's First. I've gotten plenty of response on that, and more data has come in. And recently I was intrigued by another gentleman contacted me and said, I've got something important I want to tell you, and then I can't get him to follow up. So it's a little maddening.
Well, hopefully he'll be able to get a hold of you, prompted by listening to this interview. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com. Sign up and become a member, and we will see you at the top of the next hour.